It's interesting that I'm sharing the same day that we're Skyping with Cal and Lori. I wonder if there's any parallel in what I'm sharing and what they've shared. I'll leave that up to you and how God will speak to you. So I'll set it up. You notice there's a map back there. Oh, it's looking a little weird. Oh, you tried to make it bigger, didn't you? Okay, good. So that's Vietnam on the coast. You see a big sign, Vietnam. It's in the shape of an S. If you look at the top two red thumbtacks, there's Hanoi is on the inner one, and Haiphong is close to the water. I will be referring to that a little bit. And then up north of Haiphong, where you see a white line that sort of covers the country, that's the border with China, and there's Hong Kong. So those are sort of some of the places that I will mention in my stories. So back in July, I was planning a trip with my daughter Rebecca to Langley for volleyball, and I was using my calendar on my phone, and I was swiping it, and I swiped one too many times and ended up on September. And there was nothing written on September, but sort of the number 16 kind of jumped out of me at me, and I thought, I thought about it for a couple minutes, and I thought, September 16, 1984, that's the day my family came to Canada. And then I thought, it's 2014, did a bit of math, hey, 30 years, I can't believe it's been 30 years. And so in thinking about that, reflecting on that, I just felt this overwhelming sense of gratitude. It's gratitude for the life that I have now and for all that has happened, but for what I have now. And so I thought, well, you know, when you feel like you have a good, you receive something from God, you kind of want to share it with people around you. And so that so I decided to share my story at Rotary, which I'm a member of. And then I came to church that week, and Barry was sharing about Exodus, the Israelites and their Exodus. And then I thought, oh, we were called the boat Exodus. So I thought, I wonder if I should be sharing at church as well. So I told Nancy and Barry that I think I should share in September. And then a month ago, so in October, maybe 3 weeks ago, I went to Barry and Nancy and said, I changed my mind. Not sharing anymore. And they said, why? And Nancy just persisted and didn't let me get out of it. So thank God for that. So how many of you have heard of the Vietnam War? Just put up your hands if you have. Okay. Well, to Vietnamese people, it's known as the American War. So it's kind of a matter of perspective, right? So Vietnam was at war for about 30 years, from 1945 to 1975. First was with the French, and then with the U.S. The French were defeated in, some of you might be familiar with the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954. And also at the same time, the people in France were really questioning their government's efforts to colonize Indochina, which included Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. But the U.S. got involved in 1962 because there was a fear of the domino effects of communism. And as a result of the war, 2 million people fled Vietnam between 1978 to 1995. Many of them fled by boat, so that's why they were known in the media as the boat people or the boat exodus. So in terms of my own story and my family story, in 1972, in the midst of war, my mom was pregnant for the sixth time. And so they would run whenever they hear the sound of airplanes because it meant there was bombing coming. So they'd run to the nearest shelter. Even though they lived on boats, they sort of tried to find the nearest shelter. But when it was over, they'd go back to do whatever they were doing before. Life went on as usual. We were in the north, so a lot of the fighting happened more in the south, but they did also have lots of bombing there in the 70s. So one day she felt some contractions, And she told my dad, go get your bicycle. They're on a boat, but they had a bicycle. And take me to the clinic, which is the nearest in the nearest village. And so mom got on the back seat. The bikes had a back seat and dad pedal. And so if you could visualize, some of you who are from Kemmer River, visualize Beaver Lodge trails with just a few more potholes and ditches on either side because they're rice fields, and so it's very narrow. So they're riding their bikes, or dad's pedaling the bike, and then about 5 minutes in, mom's like, stop, stop, turn back, the baby's coming now. So of course he turned back, and then hopped on the boat, and the neighbor on the boat, in the boat next door, as soon as she saw the comeback, she hopped on our boat and delivered the baby. So can you guess who that baby was? Yeah, it's me. Yes, I was born on a boat. So let's fast forward to 1981. I was 9 years old. I was sent to Haiphong, which is the thumbtack that I just mentioned to you, nearest the water up at the top there, to spend some time with my uncle and my four older cousins, because my dad had intended to retire there, to sell his boat and retire there. But one night, my dad showed up unexpectedly. I was excited at first, and then I hugged him, and as I let go, I saw a very sad and worried look on his face. And I also noticed the more gray hairs than of just weeks ago when I saw him, and he was covered with mud and dirt. My dad had walked through the night and all day that day to get to where I was. And 2 days later, my 15-year-old brother, Kwan, showed up on a little bicycle. I knew something was not right, but I didn't understand what was happening. A couple days later, my dad told me he wanted me and my cousin Hung was about 18, to go to King Mon with him. So dad, again, the bicycle story, dad pedaled, Hung sat on the back seat, and I sat between the handlebars. So that's how we traveled for 35 kilometers from Haiphong to King Mon, and a lot of it on dirt road. So it was kind of a bumpy ride for me. So when we got to the edge of the river, my dad gave instructions for Hung and I to cross the river and look for my brother's best friend, Kwan's best friend. And his name was Hung as well. He told us to find Hung, ask him to take us to the boat, near, as close to the boat as possible, and get a message to my mom and Dan that my dad and Kwan were okay and that they should try and leave as well. So we snuck up along the beach toward the boat, just hiding behind just mounds of pebbles and rocks along the way. When we were within about 50 meters of the boat, we saw my brother Dan, who was about 12 or 13, standing at the front of the boat. My cousin whistled and caught Dan's attention. They communicated by signing, and Dan, they made sure that Dan saw me, and he waved us away, like, leave. And so my cousin and I said goodbye to the other Hung, and we crossed the river to meet my dad, and we returned to Haiphong that night. I woke up the next morning, and my dad was gone. So several days later, my mom and my 13-year-old brother Dan also arrived in Haiphong. They escaped during the night from the boat and walked for 20 kilometers until they arrived at my aunt's house. And then they stayed there for the night, and then the next day they walked for another 20 kilometers. They took the longer route because my aunt's house was a little bit out of the way. My dad spent the next month or so traveling by night to different towns and villages in hope of collecting debts that were owed to him. Many of those trips were really wasted because people either didn't have money or just chose not to pay. Mom took us three kids to stay with relatives in Kamtha, closer to the border. And some of you might know it as Halong Bay area. Some relatives avoided us or made it really uncomfortable, so we knew we were not welcome. Fortunately, my dad's youngest sister took us in. Eventually, Dad met up with us, but he only stayed for one night. I still remember the day that my dad left Halong Bay. I begged him to take me along, even though my mom had assured me that she would take me to see him once he had a cabin built on an island. I really thought that my brothers and I were abandoned that day. While Dad hid on Dongchan Island, Mom went looking for her younger brother, Uncle Zhu, and told him our situation. My uncle and aunt gathered their four young children, ages 2 to 8, on their boat and came for us. He figured the police would be coming for him next, as he had been involved in helping people leave the country. We all got on the boat in Halong Bay on September 2nd, 1981. September 2nd is similar to our July 1st in Canada. They chose that day strategically. And they sailed to Dongchan Island to pick up my dad. We were 11 in total, 4 adults, 2 teenagers, and 5 children. So we sail our boat to our home village, Bingao, which is located at the northeastern tip of the country bordering China. So that's not the boat. So the boat that you are about to see is similar to the boat we travel on, except this boat in the picture had 2 sails and we only had 1. You'll see it eventually. So once there, we waited behind a little island until it was dark before attempting to row our boat out to sea. We huddled under the bamboo roof in the darkness of the night. Dad and uncle were the only ones outside rowing. We all sat inside, still as mannequins. It was as if we kind of froze in our individual poses. Even my 2-year-old cousin was in complete silence, which was out of character for her. Yeah, so one less sail there. So the tide was so low our boat could not pass the sandbar. We turned back to the island and waited until the next night. When it was dark and there were no signs of fishing boats nearby, we headed out toward China again. We waited, and the boat came to a stop, and then it rocked a little. We were moving again. It must have been a long time later when we were told that we were back at the island. The tide was still too low. It was close to midnight the next night when we made our third attempt. By now, we were all too familiar with the routine. Find a spot under the roof and stay as quiet as possible. We must have arrived at the sandbar because the boat has come to a stop. Dad and uncle got off the boat and tried pushing and pulling, but nothing happened. Finally, they decided to dig a trench, kind of just big enough for the deepest part of the boat to nestle through it. And then they pulled the boat across until it entered the deep waters. I must have fallen asleep along with my cousins, because the next thing I knew, I was rudely awakened by a splash of salt water and somebody crashing into me. My little cousins began to cry. I heard my mom and my aunt crying and praying to Om Jai. Om Jai is literally translated as Grandfather of the Sky. Om Jai, please save us from this storm. Save our children, they are so little. Please don't let them die. I became scared and cried along with the others. Dad, Uncle, and Quan were outside fighting against the storm to keep the boat afloat and on course. This went on for hours. Finally, the storm became calmer, the waves less angry, and the pouring rain became a little light drizzle. Daylight was approaching. The adults told us that we made it to the Chinese side of the water, and the storm was beginning to subside. We all cheered. Then suddenly, a ship came out from the Chinese side. When the ship came near our boat, I saw half a dozen men dressed in uniform with rifles pointing in our direction. Our excitement quickly turned into cries. They took my uncle and my dad onto their ship. I was frightened and confused. I'm not sure how long Dad and Uncle were questioned for, but they were eventually released, and we were told to go on our way. This was how our 90 days adventure in the China Sea began. I won't talk too much about those 90 days, but I do have some memorable moments that I will highlight. One of the things that I remember fondly is have seen dolphins swim alongside our boat and learning to talk to the dolphins. My uncle actually taught us to talk to the dolphins. Another memory that I share with my kids and my nieces and nephews, and it'll be shared lots, is one of the kids could not pee for 3 days. I think he had a stone of some sort. He was in pain. So we would kind of all waited, and when he went to pee, we'd all kind of check that, see, make sure that he, and then we would always be kind of sad and disappointed. And when he did, we all cheered the time, but then we pretended that we weren't looking because he was kind of shy too. Another memory is our boat had a leak. The boat is on the inside of the boat, it's kind of divided into three sections. So even though if there's a leak on one section, the water will enter that, but it won't enter the rest of the boat. And also other parts were used to store dry goods and food and water and that. So there was a leak in the boat at the tail end of the boat, and they tried to get the water out, but it was no good, it wouldn't work. So my uncle decided that he would dive down, and he took the shirt that he was wearing off, he dove under and used the shirt to plug up the leak. And as a result, we kind of washed onto a little island, and we were all, actually I remember everybody being prepared, they were about to, or they had already poured out water from the jerry cans that we had, there were about four, each kids were assigned to one or assigned to an adult, pieces of the boat was taken out to prepare for us to hold on to if the boat sank. But luckily when he did that, the boat didn't sink, but we washed onto a little island. And I don't know distance-wise, but I'm going to guess maybe 100 meters away from where our boat washed onto, we found a stream of fresh water. And then another memory, not so much a memory for me, it was a memory for the adults, and we've been told, is that maybe after about 2 months, so 60, 70 days at sea, a lot of it was not actually... some of it we stopped inshore. We stayed close to shore because our boat was so small and waited out storms. So we weren't out in the middle of the ocean for all 90 days. But at one point, we came across a Chinese fishing boat. Very kind people. They gave us some white rice. I think we hadn't had rice for a long time, and some meat. And then at the end of it, they talked to my uncle and aunt, and the adults understood a little bit of Chinese, not so much. So they sort of used very short words with them, and they said, small boat, small children, you're not going to make it. Give us this, your son, this little boy, he's 7. He was the cutest of us all. He was chubby and cute and active. Give us this boy, and if you make it to Hong Kong, write to us, and we'll send him. If you don't make it, at least one member of your family is alive. So that's how I'm sharing that with you, to tell you how what the sort of the state of the boat was and looked like, and how we look like on there. My aunt's response was, if we live, we live together, and if we die, we all die together. That was the adults. Okay, so in December of that year, December 1981, we arrived in Hong Kong. So in the refugee camp, that's me and my brother, and behind us is hut 125, it's called, and we lived in there and with about 20 other families. And it was kind of like a hot house, actually. In the refugee camp, I saw violence break out within 3 months being there. The fight was so big that the Hong Kong authority had to bring in the riot police. Most of the men in the camp were arrested, and many were released within days, but some were in jail for a year or longer. So Mark suggested that I share sort of what it was like, a typical day for me in the refugee camp. So I'll pick around the time I was maybe 11. So on weekdays, I would get up at about 7 in the morning. Karis, can you give me my cup of water there, please, hon? I would get up at about 7 in the morning and get ready. By that time, my parents and my oldest brother would have already gone to work. So I changed into my school uniform, a blue pants and a nice white shirt. And then I go down to the back alley behind our building to eat breakfast. There are lots of food stand behind there. And school was inside the camp, so it only took me a couple minutes to walk there. So I would play with my friends once I got there until it was time for all the students, the whole entire school, to line up by classes outside. And we'd do our morning stretching, and then we sang before we filed into our classrooms. I think school ended around 2:30. I'm not exactly sure, 2:30 or 3 o'clock. After school, I would quickly run home, change out of my uniform, put on a pot of rice, and then leave the camp to go to the nearest market, about 5 kilometers away. Much like the markets there, are much like the farmer's market here, not a grocery store, but it's outdoors. And I buy all the ingredients I needed for dinner. Typically, I would get home between 4 or 4:30, and I would prepare everything as soon as I got home, but waited until about 5:30 before I cooked. And while I wait, I probably went to play with my friends. Because my parents usually didn't get home until about 6 or later, and then they would have to wash up, and we eat our dinner. And I would, after the dishes were done and put away, then I could go outside and play with my friends for a bit before dinner, before bedtime. So that was sort of a typical day for me on weekdays. Weekends consisted of laundry duties. Anyways, so there were vendors selling various foods, especially breakfast foods, behind the building. And every morning I would stop, and most of the time I would stop by my favorite vendor who sold crepes. I recall one particular morning as I turned to leave, I stood up and turned to leave, and from the corner of my eyes, I saw one man strike another man with a machete. I was 11. The refugee camp was a dark place. Theft and robbery were rampant, fights broke out almost daily, affairs were common, and children were given adult responsibilities as parents worked long hours to pay the bills and support the family. In this dark place, God brought little candlelights of hope in the form of young missionaries like Tina, Gail, Joni, Hans, and many others. When we first arrived at the camp, I heard, if I went to the other side of the camp and attend this class, I would get some soy milk and a cookie. So my friend Kang and I went every day, faithfully, for an hour. We came home happy because our stomachs were full. That was how I met a 21-year-old missionary named Tina McKinney from what happened to my other pictures? That's Tina. Kang and I were two peas in a pod. She and her family arrived one day earlier. Her boat was number 1552, and ours was 1553. After we met Tina, we were three peas in a pod. She was our teacher, our mentor, and our big sister. We adored her. I had pizza for the very first time with Tina. The pizza was hot and crunchy, and the cheese was white and stringy. I've never had pizza that delicious again, and I suspect I never will. She took us to the Pacific Ocean Park, which is the biggest theme park in Hong Kong. She took us to the beach. She took us camping on a remote island. It was quiet, peaceful, calming, and beautiful. We had the space to relax, to dream, and to be children, just playing in the sand. She and her fellow missionaries showed us there was a bigger world than our camp, and there was hope for a better future. One of my favorite memories of Hong Kong, which actually I shared with Anna, because Anna is going to go with YWAM soon as well. So I shared with Anna and her mom a while back. One of my favorite memories of Hong Kong was sitting on the beach with Tina and Kang on a remote island one night after dinner. The sky was really dark, so the stars were bright. It was just brilliant. And Tina must have told us that God created the stars, the moon, the earth, and all the living things in it. She also told us that a group of people had gone to the moon and back. My jaw dropped like that. It was the first time I ever heard that. I was shocked by this new revelation. She told us that they were real men and women, just like her and just like us. And then she added, maybe one day you can go travel to the moon, Tan. What a fantastical thing to say to an 11-year-old child living in the refugee camp. For the rest of that night, I was lost in my own thoughts, trying to wrap my brain around this new information. So, September 16th, 1984, as I mentioned, we arrived in Vancouver, actually, that day 30 years ago. But our destination was Wild Rose Country, Calgary. Besides adjusting to the cold, snowy winter, I also experienced culture shock and just a deep longing for my friends and for things that were familiar to me. I had been a studious and high-achieving student in the refugee camp, but here in Canada I found I did not understand a word that was spoken to me or around me during my first months at school. I came home in tears most days because I could not communicate with my teachers and my new friends. I cried in the bathroom. I would tear up on the bus, and I cried myself to sleep. I felt desperately lonely. 5 months later, my uncle and aunt and cousins arrived, which made life less lonely for me. And in school, I began to understand a little more English. My English as a second language teacher, Madame de Champlain, was kind and encouraging. I felt safe during the hour that I went to her classroom each day. She took us on lots of field trips and made school really fun and pleasant for me. Mr. Gray was the principal at Sacred Heart Elementary. He always greeted me with a smile and a, "How are you?" And the very first time he asked me, I proceeded to tell him in my broken English that I was 12 years old. He smiled and walked down the hall. It wasn't until about 15 minutes later that I realized with embarrassment that I had misunderstood his question. A year later, Madame de Champlain decided I no longer needed to go to her ESL class and could remain in language art, in the language art block with my friends. I remember the very first time I was sent to the principal's office. I was.
Bad girl.
Yes. No, not quite. It was in October of my second year in Canada. Actually, my language art teacher told me to go see Mr. Gray and show him what I had written in my notebook. After reading it, he smiled and congratulated me and told me how proud he was of me. He and my teacher made all this fuss because I had written my first complete sentence without any grammatical errors. So for that, Mr. Gray invited me to help myself to his gumball machine that was on his desk. Isn't that cool? Yeah. So our journey led us here to Kemmerer River in August of 1988. The next year I met Heather, who had just moved to Kemmerer River from the Queen Charlotte's. We became friends, and Heather invited me to the Baptist youth group. I politely declined, giving a different excuse each time. But Heather never gave up. So I finally said yes, just to get her off my back. I had so much fun at youth group and met so many nice people that I continued to attend. Heather invited me to sleepovers at her house during the weekend, which of course meant going to church on Sunday. As a result, a year later, I made a decision to become a Christian. So, as a family, we have often wondered what would have happened to us if the storm had pushed us back to Vietnam. Although the storm was terrifying at the time, it was the northeasterly wind that pushed us over the border towards China before daylight. Was the storm a coincidence? Perhaps. So 6 months after we arrived in Hong Kong, another family who came from the same village also arrived. So as they were exchanging escape stories, my uncle shared with his friend that he and my dad had agreed that if we didn't cross the sandbar that third night, we would have had to go back into the village to get more supplies. His friend said, "It's a good thing you didn't have to go into the village because the police were waiting for you in your homes." Was it a coincidence we made it through that night? I also recall my mom or my aunt, not sure who, sewing a flag with a Red Cross symbol. You go to the next one with a Red Cross symbol on it. And it fluttered at the top of our mast for 90 days. My uncle had been in the Navy for a short time and thought that there was a chance that we might be rescued when we came across a ship if they saw. Did you see the flag? It's the next one. Yeah, that was flying at the top of our mast for 90 days. And our boat was washed up on the little island that I shared with you, and the stream of fresh water was nearby. Was that a coincidence? And in Hong Kong, instead of having lots of intersections, like we have intersection lights, I should say, they built a lot of overpasses for pedestrians or underground tunnels for major roads and highways. I shudder now when I think about all the times that I walked through an underground tunnel to and from the markets by myself during those 3 years. I recalled running as fast as I could through the tunnel a few times when I had to cross it in the evening. There were many, and I've heard other stories about what have taken place in the tunnel. There were many other potentially dangerous situations. I think I must have had a couple of guardian angels watching over me. Otherwise, I don't think I would be here today. So looking back at my journey now, I see all those quote-unquote coincidences as divine interventions. The storm, the wind, the fresh water, the candlelights of hope, the guardian angels. And you know that Red Cross flag? I think it was just a little extra sign for the cynic in me. I hope through my story you will have a new appreciation for the life that you currently have, for the fact that you and I are living in a country where we can freely gather here to talk and share about anything we want to, including our faith, for the clean water that you enjoy every day, for free education, for free health care, for clean air, for security, and most importantly, for freedom. I also hope the next time you meet someone who is a new immigrant, I know we're all immigrants, but new immigrants, or a refugee from another country, that you will make them feel welcome and take the time to hear their story. Thank you.